So welcome back to the session 3. So welcome back to the session 3. We have looked upon various aspects of smartphone biometrics. Now comes the main part of adapting the smartphone biometrics. Are the people really ready to adapt biometrics? Are the biometrics usable in the smartphones? And there's a new study on usability factors, and that would be presented by Sir Luke Sprivers. Luke is not an unknown face to all of us. He has been visiting UWIC for some time now. I think the presentation would be enjoyable also. Welcome, Luke.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm holding the microphone because I don't like it on my head. But I presume that I will be audible to people.
Okay, better? Good. So I'm Luke Sprivers from the University of Twente, and as I saw before the break Patricio introduce his university, I thought this is a great idea, so I will start with that too. Our logo is at the top, University of Twente, and the best thing I can tell about the logo is that it is a unique font. Yeah? You will find this font nowhere else. The University of Twente is actually in a city, Enschede, in the Netherlands, exactly in the middle of Europe, as you can see here. Yeah? It is the one and only campus university in the Netherlands, yeah? With some very interesting and new buildings recently. It is a relatively small university, founded in 1961, has about 10,000 students, and our motto is high-tech human touch. So that is about the university, and now we'll quickly zoom in on our group. Our group is the Biometric Pattern Recognition Group, BPR, and we are part of the Department of Electrical Engineering, Mathematics, and Computer Science. Yeah? And we are also part of a chair, the Chair for Services, Cybersecurity, and Safety, which is a rather large group. Our group, as you can see here, consists of our leader, Remo Veldhuis, who is also sitting at the back over there, myself, Professor Didier Mervli, and a very esteemed technician over there, a number of PhD students and postdocs and visiting students. Now, I can also say that we are actually the one and only biometrics research group, academic research group in the Netherlands. So we have an interesting position. I don't know if this is caused by me walking around. We'll see. I try not to stamp the floor. Our mission, of course, is do research in biometrics. Yeah? We do different types of research, and our main applications are identity and access measurements. I don't know what happens with the screen every time. Do you know? Is it because I walk around, or because...
This, what adapter? This one. The screen adapter, this one, over here. But it's plugged in well, I think. Well, let's see how it works.
So our main applications are identity and access management and law enforcement. And then you can think about using biometrics for passports. Yeah, we have a number of projects around passports together with the Dutch government, for example. If you ever enter Schiphol, and use the automatic passport checks over there, yeah, we were involved there in setting this up and in evaluating the performance of those systems. Also, mobile biometrics, which I will talk about later. And if you look at, for example, law enforcement, we do a lot of work in surveillance context. Yeah? So if you think about low-quality facial recognition, distance, face recognition from a distance, things like that. Yeah, and We also do a lot in evaluation. How do you set up a proper evaluation experiment? So we address all kinds of modalities, and our main modalities are fingerprint, face recognition, vesicular pattern recognition, multiple biometrics, and we also work on privacy protection. And as a matter of fact, we also develop sensors. Our research is both application directed. You can see in biometrics nowadays that maybe most of the research is application directed. You want to develop new applications, you want to develop working systems. But we want to stress also that the theoretic part is also very important. So understanding what happens is important. And that is also a thing we work on. And finally, we found the last years that from many parties, from governmental parties, from police, from also from companies, there exists a lot of questions about biometrics. How well do these systems really operate? Do they also operate in the situation that we want to apply them? So we get lots of questions from that, and we have multiple projects evaluating these things with sometimes very intriguing results. Okay, what type of research we do? We will quickly go through a number of things that we do. We worked on 3D facial recognition, and as a matter of fact, got very, very good results. We were on the top performing systems for the 3D facial recognition. Yeah. A second thing is you can also reconstruct 3D facial information from image sequences or from multiple images. So we also did work on that, reconstruction from multiple viewpoints in the end, 3D facial model, and use that for 3D or 2D facial recognition. Another interesting topic is suppose you have a facial recognition system but want to use it for a degraded photograph, a poor quality photograph. The question here was, can you predict what your facial recognition system, how the performance of your facial recognition system will degrade? So we also did research on that. And in that case, you can make plots of quality versus performance. These are things that are very useful to know. So we develop sensors, and like Christoph has his blue box, we have a black box for finger vein recognition, finger vein acquisition. And we also set up a data set and did some experimental work, and we still continue working on that. Christoph will be thrilled, by the way, that we also are into standards, yeah, especially for forensic biometric evidence quantification. Yeah, Didier Meubly is operational in that. And then another interesting thing, we had a PhD student who just finished who investigated multi-biometrics fusion of different modalities or different types of scores maybe, where you know that there's a dependency between the scores. So you cannot use simple fusion strategies. You need something like a model of this dependency. And he worked on that, which is very, very interesting and sometimes very complicated as well, I can tell you. And finally, also we work on biometric template protection. Well, we have, if you look at the research we started now and we continue to do in the future, smartphones take an important place there, so we started work on smartphones and I will present some of that in the next presentation. We work on privacy protection, especially in facial recognition. We work in, for facial recognition under uncontrolled situations. Yeah? So large variations in pose we are going to address, large illumination variations, and especially also facial recognition at large distances where you have very low resolution in facial images. And we work a lot in the law enforcement things. Also, like, for example, if you want to use biometrics to prove something, you need to know what a score means. How can you convince that a score of 0.9 means anything useful for a judge? Right? You have to interpret that, you have to calibrate those scores, and that's a lot of work as well. And finally, also, I wrote there, we are starting to work with deep learning. And you can see in deep learning, this is a typical thing where people say, okay, this is very useful, and it's useful because it's a powerful technique. And on the other hand, you also see that people just use it, and that's it. Yeah? They say, okay, we have a great solution, fantastic. But deep learning does not mean deep understanding. We would like to employ deep learning in such a way that we also learn something from it. And maybe in the end, by learning from this deep learning, know the techniques that are basically developed in these deep learning systems and apply those systems ourselves and maybe even get further ahead by not using deep learning, but by using the techniques that are apparently developed using these deep learning strategies. So we don't just want deep learning, we want deep understanding. So that was a little introduction about our group. And I will now continue with the presentation on my presentation on the mobile phone stuff. Just a second. There we are. Yeah. So this is not a general talk about usability of mobile phones in biometrics. No, it's actually a very specific reporting of some work we did on facial recognition using a mobile phone using a passport reader application. Yeah? So you will see what it's about. So it's a specific usability study, as a matter of fact. Now, of course, you could say facial recognition on a mobile phone, it exists. Why would you like to research that? Yeah? Of course, probably some of you use it as well. Let's see if I can show it. Yeah, so you know how to use it. You can lock your phone, present your face like this, and the phone is unlocked. As a matter of fact, I use it myself on my little, very cheap phone. It was only 40 euros, and it works. It's actually very convenient, and most of the time it works reasonably well. If you adapt a little bit to the illumination circumstances, you look towards the light source and you move your head around a little bit, it works reasonably well. And since I checked, as a matter of fact, my phone, if I switch it on, does not show my name. So if someone nicks my phone, he doesn't know my name normally, and he cannot unlock my phone, I hope. Yeah? Of course, if he took out the SIM card or the memory card, he probably would be able to find out who I am, and once he knows who I am, yeah, then it's very easy to fool a system like that, though it's not really secure. No, that's wrong. So once he knows who I am, he can Google me on the internet, he can find pictures, maybe even movies from me, and then it's very easy to fool a system like that. So here, someone recorded the photograph or a small movie, and you can see how easily it unlocks your phone. And even the simple liveness detection, like blinking the eyes, of course, will be fooled by this because you also have blinking eyes on a small video. So it works perfectly like that. So it's not very secure. Now, the project we did was somewhat different. It's called MAVI, Mobile Application for Identification Verification, and it's a project together with a small company in Ovalle and the University of Twente. And what we did was investigate how we could do verification using a passport, combined with facial recognition. Now, how does this work? This company in Ovalle developed an application with which you can read your own passport using your mobile phone. Yeah, if you have a mobile phone with NFC, you can read your own passport, read the major information, and I can show again a small movie how it works. Yeah, so this application is called ReID, and what you need is, of course, a phone with this NFC. So first you scan the readable area of your passport. With that, you can decode, as a matter of fact, the chip in your passport. So now you put your passport towards the phone, so the NFC can read the data from your passport. And then, in a few seconds, it can show all the data. You can see the photograph in relatively high resolution, much higher than what you have on your passport,
available.
And you can read the data, and there are even some checks if your passport is a valid passport. So it's a nice, neat application. And of course, you can think about applications for an app like this. Now, more information, readid.com. I promise to show that to them. And I asked permission to show this, so then I have to show some more. Okay, so what kind of applications can you think about if you use your passport for something? So it's a completely different application than unlocking your phone, right? So for example, if you open a bank account, this is typically a situation where banks ask you to present a copy of your passport. Sometimes you can open a bank account through the mail, you send a copy of your passport and some data, and then they open a bank account for you. Yeah? Now, of course, sending a copy of your passport is not really the most secure way to open a bank account. The banks will have to trust that you sent a copy of the passport. It's not stolen somewhere or copied from somewhere. So they have to be sure you sent the copy of the passport. And sometimes the copies are of poor quality. They only show part of your passport. So it would be nice for the banks if they can really have an app like this where you can send the original data of your passport online. That would already be helpful. Yeah, they can read more information. And maybe you can also say to the banks, okay, I will only share certain information for my passport with you. So it has some possibilities. No? So you could also think of other things. I do remember that once when I ordered a flight ticket, I also had to hand in a copy of my passport. And there are some things if you, for example, well, I could imagine that if you want to extend your passport, apply for a new renewal, then you also could need to send in a copy of your passport. Things like that, yeah. Governmental things, maybe for elections, this could be useful. Now, as I already told you, if you send a copy of your passport, of course it's hard to check if this is really your passport. And this still holds if you send the copy by your phone, because someone could have stolen your passport, right? So the banks, etc., would like to know if you are really the person who sends the passport. Now, you can do that by a check. One check could be, for example, by fingerprint. So you could record a fingerprint using your phone, for example, and check if it's on the same one on the passport, because on the passport, in modern passports, there are also fingerprints stored. Unfortunately, just wait a second, Christoph. The fingerprints on the passport are not accessible to mortals. They're only accessible to basically the country that issued the passport. So that's a problem. You cannot use that. But you can use the digital photograph on the passport. Well, you already saw it. It can be shown also on the phone. So you can use this. So you could say, okay, we can check if the person who sends this passport information is the person by doing a check between the passport photograph and a live photo recording, a selfie. That is a possibility. Now, if you do this comparison, of course, the banks will probably say, we don't want to do this comparison on the phone itself because we don't trust your phone. So we will probably want to do this face comparison on the server. So now, slowly, this specific application is taking the right form. So we would like to do the face comparison on the server. And of course, you would need some liveness checks to be sure that it's not a photograph, etc. Not just pick the photograph from your passport and send that together with the passport. That would be quite ugly. So this is actually the application that we investigated here. What do you need if you want something like this? And banks are interested in things like this. So this is what we investigated. Yeah? So that is the research, the main research question. If we have a live image, a selfie, let's say, someone who wants to open a new bank account, a selfie photo with a passport photo, and you want to do the comparison. So it's different from what you have on your normal facial unlock for your mobile phone. Now, one important thing is the quality of the selfie. If you ask people to make just a selfie of themselves, the quality will vary, of course. Some people will be well-informed and they know they have to sit in front of a light source and not with a light source behind their backs, etc. But many people will be quite ignorant about those things and will have poor quality selfies. So what is the influence of the quality of the selfie on the facial recognition performance, given that we are using some kind of top-ranking commercial facial recognition software on a central server? And the other thing is, you can already understand that, of course, there is a problem with the quality, so we want to give feedback to the user using some kind of application, how he can make good selfies. And then finally, we also need some kind of liveness detection. So remember again, this is quite different from what we had in the facial unlock, because for the facial unlock, you basically use a very recent image of yourself when you enroll. You can also enroll multiple images with different illumination. It improves the results. I checked that too. Well, kind of works. And also, it's reasonably convenient to do a retry. If you fail, you just try again, and it's not that inconvenient. However, here, if you want to do a retry, you have to send your passport information and the live image and wait until the server is ready, and then you get a message, oh, it's not good, and you have to do it again. So that's very cumbersome and not very user-friendly. So, and the other thing is that you have a single old passport photo as a reference, and this age difference is also quite big. So these are the things that play in the background over here. Now, quality of selfies. Quality of selfies can differ quite a lot. So people hold their phones in different ways, and they make selfies like these. Some people like to look like this. I really saw it. If they make selfies, they do things like this. And you can have small other pose problems as at the bottom. And then, of course, you can have other problems. The first one, you can look sleepy, like I did then. But this actually is quite a nice photograph. So it's frontal, it's well illuminated. The second one has illumination from the back, and clearly we see that this is a poor image, and it will probably completely fail on all kinds of facial recognition systems. But even if you have a somewhat better illuminated situation where you still have illumination from the back, I know from experience this will give problems with facial recognition. And then finally, on the right, you can see that the left part of the face is much brighter than the right part of the face, and this is also a typical problem for facial recognition systems. And then, as a matter of fact, we also took some pictures in bright sunlight where you have really hard shadows, etc., and sometimes even huge overexposure in the images. So, what were the results? I will not go into details, but I can summarize them in a very easy way. They were poor. So we did not have very good recognition results. We could even go to down to 40% of verification rates at a false accept rate of 0.1%. So that was pretty poor. And we saw that even if we threw out the really poor images with larger poses, images with only small poses and with, I would say, reasonable illumination still, quite often gave very poor scores. So that's not good for an application like this. You want something better. So even light from behind with a reasonably well visible face still gave poor performance, small poses. And another interesting cause was sometimes the poor quality of the passport photograph. We saw very interesting examples of that. So, and that's very hard to handle, of course. So, one big conclusion was that apparently it is going to make sense to instruct users how to make good selfies. And how can you do that? So, with students, we designed an application for mobile phones that gives you some feedback on that. So it will show you the direction of light, and with some simple instructions, if you know how to use it, you can be helped to make better illumination, a better homogeneous illumination of your face. It shows you also the pose, and it performs a few simple liveness checks at first. And then, as a matter of fact, it also shows the score of our in-house developed facial recognition system. The methods that we used were actually very straightforward. If you have a face over here, we first do some pre-processing. We detect the face itself. We detect landmarks like the eyes, the nose, and some landmarks near the mouth, etc., around the face. so that you have plenty of landmarks. There are some good packages for that on the internet nowadays. It's open source. And once you have those, you can place the face in the center of the image, of the screen, and you can determine a number of the things that I described. So for example, illumination, direction of illumination, you can very simply detect by splitting the face in two. If you have the landmarks, that's a simple thing. Measure the average illumination on the one side, and then the average illumination on the other side of the face, and you can easily detect where the light is coming from. Yeah? And you can give an instruction to the user based on that. Then the pose. Well, the method that we chose was the relative position of the tip of the nose to the eyes. Yeah? If the face turns, yeah, the tip of the nose will get closer to the left or the right eye, depending on what direction you rotate. And also, if you rotate your face up or down, the tip of the nose will come closer to the eyes or further away from the eyes. So it's actually quite easy to get an idea of the pose. You can measure it reasonably well. And then the simple liveness things were the standard things like eye blinks. You simply cut out the area of the eye and you measure differences, changes there in time. And pose variation, you can measure. So you can say, okay, for example, I want to know if this face is a real face by detecting 3D properties from the face. If you move your face like this, you can see that the pose varies, as opposed to if you have a flat sheet of paper and you move it, the tip of the nose will have the same relative position to the eyes all the time. So you can measure those things, and you have a simple way to determine if this is a real face or not. Now, this is the app that we developed in the end. You can see now, I'll point to a few things over here. So the image, the facial image is centered in the center of the image, of the display. And at the top over here, we have a reference image. This is me from my passport, obtained with the passport application, by the way. This is the current normalized image from the live image, which is compared to this one, and here we give a score of our in-house facial recognition system. So in this case, you can easily see that the two images are very much alike, so the score is quite high. It's a score between 0 and 1, and normally scores above 0.1, 0.15 are pretty okay for this facial recognition system. Then here at the bottom, you can see if the pose is okay. You can see illumination okay, liveness, and there's something with blinking. I don't know how much time I have. Where are we? I should speed up. Okay, I will speed up. So I will show quickly this application, how it works. Now I'm going to move on my chair there, and you can see now the light is coming from the right side, and there's a bar on the right that shows the illumination. Yeah. Also, I will move to the other side, and then you can see that first illumination goes back to normal, and then it should move to the other side. Yeah. Also, if you can see that if we have the illumination from the side, the score, the recognition score, is dropping quite a lot. Yeah. There will also be an indication of pose. So if I rotate my head, it will give, using an arrow, it will give you an indication of the pose of the face. Yeah? And at this moment, I will stop it because the movie is a little bit longer, and I understand that I don't have a lot of time anymore. So another thing was that we did a selfie check with the paper over here, a piece of paper with my image on it. I will move it a little bit so it can. Yeah, so here I put a paper on it in front of the camera. You can see the score should be pretty okay. And now I'm trying to rotate it, but the liveness at the bottom over here says it's not okay because it cannot detect this 3D. So that's also pretty nice. So you can give feedback. The only problem we had to handle was that we could not make the application really fast enough to work on a mobile phone. Now, for what liveness detection and spoof detection, etc., about that, with simple tools, so we could detect if there is a piece of paper or a flat mask, for example, but we could use advanced liveness detection, and we think that for advanced liveness detection, you would need a challenge response approach. For that, we detected the pose of the face. We make the user move a dot in a pattern, as a matter of fact, very much like a swipe pattern that you may have, but now you do it with your face. And it worked pretty well. Unfortunately, I don't have the movie, but you can easily understand that if you have a user interface like this, you can move the dot over there to the design position, and you can make a pattern. And that worked pretty well. And it's a challenge response thing, and it's more secure. So now I come to the conclusions. I still hope I have some time for that. So the quality of the selfie has great impact on the facial recognition results. It definitely makes sense to give the user feedback, and we did some development on that. And we developed some kind of advanced liveness detection using a challenge response approach. And as a matter of fact, many students had a lot of fun developing these things on a mobile phone, because if you can look at it and show it to others, this is real fun. This research is not finished yet. We continue that. And one of the things we will add is now tracking to make everything much faster. And we already had a student developing this tracking. It only has to be integrated. And I think that's it.
Thank you, Luke. I think we will have Luke on the panel, so we can ask the question straight away in the panel discussion.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. May I give you this to you?
I would now invite the speakers in the panels. Rolf Sundermann, Javier, Patrizio, Raymond.
Good. So thank you, Kiran, for guiding through the day. We have now panelists here on the floor. We don't have Martin yet. Martin can also sit here because it was a speaker. So the panel has actually two, panel discussion slot has two ideas. Number one, we have collected over the day a few questions that are open, and I think we should pose those, and I read them out so you don't have to turn around. During the day, it was possible to rate those, and maybe we start with that. That's the first part, and we take that for about 20-25 minutes. And then the second part, and you can also start to think about this, is what are topics that we reveal today that deserve a more elaborate future attention. And for those who come more often to this room and to our events, you may recall that 2 years ago we had in this room the International Workshop on Biometrics and Forensics. This was a workshop that was part of the so-called COST Action, which is a European funding instrument that enables the travel and exchange of researchers, and we had a cost action on biometrics and forensics. So this was the starting point for this workshop series. Now, the idea that we have, and Raymond and Javier and Patrizio and myself, we had a preliminary discussion on this, is we have in the scope of our today's workshop, smartphone-based biometrics, so many open questions. We should potentially have proposal being submitted for a new cost action addressing those. And so the second part of this panel will then be devoted to this. Good. So I suggest we start with the first top-rated question that is obviously for Rolf. And the question reads, what is for a FIDO authenticator the acceptable false accept rate? You mentioned, I think if I recall well, you mentioned that this must be specified. But what is it concretely? We have seen in, I think, Luke's presentation a number that aligns with the Frontex specification of a false accept of 0.1%. We have that as a somehow standard for automated border control, biometric systems in border control. But what is in your FIDO group the perspective on acceptable security?
Very interesting question.
Does this work?
Yeah.
So, two answers to that. So, first is FIDO itself, that is, at this time, specifies interoperability. It does not specify security or false accept rates. So any FIDO authenticator could come with any false accept rate at once, right? It could be a 100%, it could be a 50%, it could be a 0.1%, whatever you want. However, that's the first part. The second is we are working on a security evaluation scheme for FIDO authenticators, and we will come up with a more strict rule, which is typically oriented on what people today are doing. And if you are aware of the current industries, I think Apple came back with 1 in 50,000 fault accept rate for the iPhone, still allowing five fingers, so you might argue that this is equivalent to 1 in 10,000. Google, I think, in the Google CDD, the device compliance requirements, specifies 1 in 10,000. So I think we will end up with a number which is close to that and not, let's say, exceeding that thing. There was an argument being made that from a security perspective, 1 in 1,000 would be okay, good enough, because what is the attack really? Is this I bring 1,000 friends and they all try to break my phone? That's typically not the attack we will see in reality. The real attack is someone is lifting off your fingerprint from the device itself and now creating a rubber finger, and now we're in the presentation attack scenario. So in my opinion, 1 in 1,000 could be sufficient. I think we will end up more likely with 1 in 10,000 because this is obviously what the industry currently has achieved. So why should we, let's say, go back? So somewhere, I think, in that ballpark it will be. It's not fixed yet, and this is only for security certification, right? There is no, this is not mandatory, so yeah. You can do whatever you want today.
Yeah. Maybe you can hand the microphone to Javier, because the next question, or question number four, is very closely related. It reads out, state-of-the-art signature recognition, you report equal error rate. What would be a reasonable operating point in terms of false accept rate and false reject rate for a banking application? So somehow in line with that, if we have smartphones but dedicated to banks, you have talked with many of the banks, what do they require and why do you not, I think I can read this question in the sense, why do you not report reject rate at a false accept rate that corresponds to the CQ2 level that they want to see?
Okay. Well, if you check my slides, you could see the death plots in which you can find the point, the operating point you want to use. I think 1 in 1,000 for FRR could be achievable for FRRs less than 5%, for instance, which in my view could be a good point for behavioral biometrics. But of course, you have to take into account what he said. This is very important. What is the chance, the a priori probability that you have a real attack? This is very important because you cannot wait in the same way a user attempt presentation attack, for instance. You have to have those figures. What is the a priori probability that you have a real attack? So, but I think 1 in 1,000 we can live with that. In any case, the application we are developing for banking applications, for in situ banking applications, those that's a kind of guide for the supervisor. Okay, You go to your bank, to a branch, and there is always a supervisor, okay? But he cannot really check from the visual point of view what is how two different signatures are similar, if those are similar enough or not. Okay, so the application is leading this guy in the way that from 0 to 100, what is the similarity between the registered signature and the current signature? Mm-hmm. More than something which is just accept or reject from that point of view. So that would be my answer to the question.
Thank you for that. Next question here on the list is also regarding your presentation. Hervé, it reads, writing on mobile devices requires habituation. Can the enrolled model anticipate the properties of the device, surface characteristics, stylus, such that models can be used trans-devices?
Well, that's a nice approach to the interoperability problem. Mm. I think you can do that. You can detect what the device is beforehand, or you, from the handwriting itself, you can extract characteristics and then construct models which are robust enough to this problem. Anyway, there is a de facto standard in handwriting capability devices, which is the Wacom standard, which is widely used in the majority of the good devices with pressure sensitivity. And that means that even if you go to different devices, even mobile or tablet or phablet or whatever, the de facto standard means that probably that good device is using the Wacom screen. So in that sense, in many cases, what you find is really different device doesn't mean different real input signals.
So there's a de facto standard for the surface properties that I have the same
feel. Surface properties, yeah. But in the sense that the majority of the devices are using this technology, this specific technology.
Okay. Good. Next question again on signature. Which presentation attacks to be considered for signature recognition? Are signing robots generating synthetic signatures in use? Okay.
Well, I asked last year to another speaker this exact question. We are not working on synthesizing robots or something like that. We are not working on that. I cannot answer to that part of the question. Regarding the first part, I would say that when I show some results from forgeries, okay, forgeries are presentation attacks. I mean, in the sense that someone is watching how you produce your own signature, okay? How do we do that in order to have databases? What we do is to reproduce on the screen in a timely and dynamic manner, also reproducing pressure, and the attacker can reply as many times as he or she wants, so that the reconstruction or the production of the signature is very, very similar to the attacked one. So in that sense, when we are presenting forgery results, that's a very, very, let's say, it's quite optimistic in the sense that that could be the best attacks we could find from the human point of view. Not professionals, I mean, not professional attackers, but at least people trying to copy or to mimic what you are doing.
The next question again, the last one on signature. Can you combine finger signature recognition with finger tip recognition?
Yeah.
I think that relates to your finger signatures.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. That would be a very nice application. if you could use also the fingertip on also the fingertip veins to do fused multimodal biometric authentication. Mm. Absolutely, yes. Very nice question. Very nice approach.
Good. Our next question is not on signature anymore. I think it was maybe created for Aaron or Martin. I don't know, but I would pose it to Martin. It reads, does using the camera for ocular iris face biometrics to get access to a phone lead to a Big Brother is watching you privacy issue? Maybe you can comment on this and reduce the concern, if there is.
So, if you consider the ecosystem that Aaron Rose proposed, where you actually send data off. It's just me who is not turned on. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so in the ecosystem that Aaron proposed, where you would actually send data from the phone to some remote server location, you could potentially give this kind of argument against it, because then you don't actually have so much control over who is getting access to the data, or you basically have to trust the people running the back-end system. But if you instead consider more like the FIDO approach, where you just authenticate yourself against the device and then you use the cryptographic system in the background to authenticate against the server. So then you don't have this problem where any of your data will actually leave the device, and you can be at least more certain. Of course, you can never know 100% what happens, but at least you can be more certain that the data doesn't leave your device.
Mm. Yeah.
So if you look into existing device ecosystems, it's interesting to see that, for example, the image of the fingerprint sensor is not exposed to normal apps, right? And this is because you never know what kind of apps the user is installing and whether the user can trust that application. So that's a fundamental issue on those devices, right? And the answers the industry is giving to that depends a bit on whether this is a JavaScript application loaded from some server, where, let's say, W3C has its own set of answers to those challenges, or whether this is a native app running on the phone. But this pattern that not all data is exposed to apps, I think is you can even see that more with the infrared filters cameras nowadays have, which cannot be switched off by normal applications, right? It's just controlled in TEEs, in trusted execution environments, and the same with ER LEDs, right? If you want to turn on those things for illumination purposes in the infrared, you have to live inside the TEE. That's not exposed to any normal application. So obviously the industry is making the device an agent, a trusted agent of the user, making sure that even malicious applications cannot do too bad things and try to limit whatever data is exposed to those applications, which might be, let's say, a bit hindering for Aaron's approach to say, okay, we send all data off to the server to do more processing there.
Okay, the next question reads, Internet of Things is a hot topic. I think I would tend to give that to Patrizio, so please listen and receive the microphone. How would we authenticate to an Internet of Things device in the future, especially in the light of empty default passwords and weak passwords leading to large-scale attacks? The author is in the room, can augment on the question. If the author already left, then you have to answer the question from what we read.
Oh, well, in a sense, it's a good question, because nowadays, with the Internet of Things, you can control many devices in your house, so you can easily make your fridge attack yourself or your oven do something really bad to your house. So, not to talk about the possibility, to intercept your car and change some parameters while you are driving. So essentially, that's a real problem. So the point is how we can authenticate ourselves with respect to IoT devices. Of course, we could use passwords, but it's not the usual trend. We can use biometrics as well. For example, we can remotely get access to our house devices using our mobiles. This maybe could be an application. So we log in the device in the mobile through the mobile, and we can control the application in that way. So if I can understand somehow the question, that's a possible answer.
To Rolf again. Is FIDO addressing mass attacks, e.g. Yahoo, or also providing protection against targeted attacks on selected individuals, e.g. politicians?
Yeah, very interesting question. So let me start with analyzing what mass attacks are, and there are different kinds of mass attacks, right? For example, there is a mass attack on stealing billions of passwords from servers. And I would definitely answer yes, that's exactly the intention of FIDO, to protect against those mass attacks. Now, if you look into the Yahoo case, this is a special one, right? This is what has been exposed is usernames and passwords, and FIDO aims to protect against exactly that. There still might be the attacker going after a server, a central database, and getting access to all this data, and weak passwords might be involved there, but that's not weak passwords in the hand of users, it's weak authentication system in the hand of the internal IT, right? How do I, as an employee of Yahoo, authenticate to those systems? And the response is, yes, FIDO has been designed to protect against that. That was a primary reason for Google to start working on this topic, because they have been attacked by nation state actors in the past. And so they had to come up with some kind of protection mechanism for their internal stuff as well. The next thing is targeted attacks against politicians. Now, if you go targeted attacks, right, this is not only the scalable one, so you need physical protection against physical attacks as well. So in general, FIDO can do that, but it depends heavily on the authenticator implementation, right? In this case, you would need a physical authenticator using some kind of secure element with user verification, which is, let's say, tightly coupled to that secure element, and the ability for the politician to understand whether he's still in possession of that authenticator or not. Right, in the smartphone case, you might be. In your wallet case, you might not really, let's say, observe that in a timely manner when someone steals that thing. So yes, you can get to that, but it really depends on the authenticator implementation, whereas mass-scale attacks we can protect against just by using FIDO principles.
Good. You can keep the microphone, because the next question is also for you, Rolf. Is it possible that a FIDO authenticator is used in the interaction with an ATM?
Yes, thanks for the question. Very good one. We have indeed worked with some of the ATM manufacturers in Europe to do exactly a proof of concept of that thing, which means that the user would not have to enter a PIN at the ATM, which might be subject to some, let's say, a camera, which an attacker might have installed. You don't have to insert any card into that ATM, right? So protection against all the card skimming attacks. The only thing you need, you stay in front of that ATM with your smartphone. You use FIDO authentication, essentially having the bank server as a back end or some server behind that ATM, and then some proximity checks that really showing that you are in front of the same ATM. Yes, they have worked on that. I think essentially the feedback was, now, with EMV and chip and PIN and all these recent changes, the market is not right to do yet another change for ATMs. That was the response from a technological perspective. It works, the proof of concept works, very, very interesting approach.
Good, thank you. Yeah, for the next question, I must admit I don't really know who should be the one to answer, so I read it out. Please all take the question and then indicate who's most comfortable to answer. And it reads, should there be more focus on the behavioral data that can be obtained unobtrusively and use this for authenticating the user during a session. I think that relates to the picture that was presented by Aaron with the obtrusive and unobtrusive mechanisms. And yeah, we have seen a lot from Luke on face recognition. We have seen eye recognition. We have seen little on unobtrusive methods. Who would like to comment on this?
So I can give a first try on that. So there is general trends on devices to augment the signals you can get to these, let's say, behavioral biometrics like gait recognition, things like that, to understand whether the device is still in possession of the legitimate user. And from there on, you know that you do not have to ask the user to bother the user again. And I think we are kind of used to that scheme when we are doing NFC kind payments, right? We just tap our card to some device, and just by the tapping action, right, it does not require any second factor to that, right? I do not have to enter a PIN. I do not have to swipe my finger, right? It's just more convenient because the system somehow assumes that the risk is okay. Now, there are different ways to reduce the risk. One is to reduce the amount of money you pay or limit that one. And the other is to know that it's very likely that the legitimate user is still in possession of that device. So in that situation, if you use these behavioral biometrics to understand, oh, yes, it's still the normal user. It's the way he walks. It's the way he takes the device out of his pocket, right, to interact with the device. In that case, you do not have to, let's say, bother the user to do any explicit action. There's a second question to that. How does that, let's say, relate to explicit user consent? And this is another thing we have to look into, especially with the unconscious the sleeping mom kind of attack, right? And is this explicitly me authorizing a $10,000 payment transaction, or is it just for, let's say, limited value things where I can assume that possession of the device is good enough for that?
Good. So let's take one more question from this list, and then we go to the open brainstorming. Regarding the security aspects of smartphone authentication, is the issue where to store the protected biometric data on the device or on a central server resolved? Maybe Raymond, also being a security expert, you can... Or did you pose this question?
I posed the question.
Ah, okay.
and the reason why I posed it is that it's a kind of mantra, a FIDO mantra, to have the data on the device and not on a central server. Mm. But sometimes I talk to people that have other solutions, and they have arguments against this. So I would like to ask the specialist what he would think about this.
So my opinion... There are different purposes, right? One purpose is authentication, the other is identification. For authentication, I have not yet seen a need to store the data on the server, and I have not yet seen, let's say, a huge benefit of storing the data or processing the data on the server. Sure, there's a processing power question. I think that's the only valid question which remains. On the other hand, there is no security benefit to that, in my opinion, and that's because the sensor, right, is still the device. And if I do not know whether the device is trusted, I cannot trust the data from the sensor because it could be captured data from the past, right? It must. The only reason why I think this is live data is because I trust the sensor to give me some kind of liveness information in addition to that thing. So from a security perspective, in the authentication case, I think there is no benefit. On the other hand, we have seen a lot of large-scale attacks against databases on server side. So I think there is a benefit of not storing sensitive data in the central databases because people typically go after that. Now, that was authentication. Identification is different. In identification, in case sometimes I need to know whether this is still the same user, right? So all these unlinkability, privacy-preserving things which we like in authentication does not apply in identification because now I have to know, as a bank, for example, whether it's still the same user which wants to recover his bank account, right? His online access to the bank account, in which case I need a proof of his identity. So I might want to use the Aadhaar database in India, for example, to verify whether it's still the user. The unresolved question in this situation is how can I make sure that this is not a single factor authentication or identification solution, right, which would be considered too weak, so it must be a multi-factor thing. And how can I make solve the I have to trust the sensor, so I must know the sensor, I need some kind of sensor attestation thing, and I need the presentation attack detection kind of aspect. And this is what I think would have to be resolved in this online identification use case, in which case a database might make sense, right? There are other solutions. If you think of the national ID cards, let's say most eIDAS schemes are based on that, they can live without central databases as well, right? So I, as a German citizen, have a German national ID card, which can be used remotely to a server to identify myself, right, to give out some proof after entering a PIN, of course, right, which is another interesting discussion to have, to where to enter that PIN and how secure that is. But in the end, I give a signed record back to the server, which includes my name and my birth date and so on, so the bank could know, oh yes, it's still Rolf Lindemann, still the legitimate owner of that banking account. So now I can maybe register as a new FIDO authenticator. So I think there might be legitimate cases, but I've seen very little. I've seen mostly concerns about privacy and being an attack target. And whenever I talk to large companies, not state actors, but companies, they typically want to avoid being an attack target. And even the large companies like Google do not want to end up in the press being, let's say, confronted with, oh, you are collecting all my biometric data, you are bad, I don't use you anymore. Because in that moment, they would lose their, let's say, their economic foundation, right? So I think very interesting question. It seems to be a trend towards storing the data on the device only, except some governmental use cases, in which case identification and central databases are used and the government can do whatever they decide. Right, that's just the way politics works.
And if you consider enrollment fraud, because if you store data on a device, someone else could store the data, for instance, you might manipulate during enrollment. And one benefit of central storage would be that if you would invest in it, you could have the enrollment procedure under control of a certain central agency.
Yes, I think that's typically the valid governmental use case, right? Where you have these known sensor, known good scenarios, supervised enrollment, then you know that thing. On the other hand, in most day-to-day authentication cases, you already rely on a lot of user devices, right? Where if I receive an SMS OTP, for example, if my smartphone is broken, right, the security model is broken of that thing. And it doesn't even have to be my smartphone. It could be the MNO's, my mobile network operator's procedure to allow someone else to order a replacement SIM card for my phone and get that injected to the system. So I don't see a huge security benefit from that.
It also occurs to me that if you always store this information on the device, you also have to trust the vendor of the sensor. Yeah? And if you have to trust the vendor of the sensor, the problem is that you are always locked in with the sensor vendor. You cannot just choose another one. And we've seen that this gives problems. There were problems with SIM cards, for example, that were produced with a backdoor. So I see that there is a possibility of problems there too. And there's a probability of the problem that if we live in an open source and open standards situation, this closed sensors can also cause problems.
Thank you for these insights. My suggestion is we now tackle the second task of this panel discussion to somehow wrap up the day, in the sense that from the discussion, from the opportunities, from the challenges that we have discussed, all the panelists would somehow give their findings on what could be topics for a new cost action. Yeah? And for those who don't know this instrument, it's a network where we have various working groups, so experts that are interested in one or the other topic. And let's say a preliminary title could be mobile biometrics and privacy protection. My suggestion is that Luke starts, because he was not that active in the question round. So you can start with your insight, and then Raymond next, Rolf, Javier, and so on. And I will try to capture what you say. So maybe some keywords first, and then you explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, the only problem, of course, is that now I have the least time to think about it.
Oh. You can come back if you want. Just make an immediate brain dump, or you say usability, or whatever.
You can also ask if there are already someone who wants to has an idea. Who wants to tell something.
So Raymond,
I had a little. Is this working?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. I had a little more time to think about this, but if you look at what's going on in biometrics, then the trends are there are 3 to 4. One is large scale biometrics, as we can see, for instance, with the Aadhaar system in India. The other thing is what we have been discussing all day is biometrics and mobile. And the third one is that biometrics are becoming invisible. They're going invisible. We will have biometric recognition without us noticing, for instance, by cameras somewhere or any other sensors in place. I think that covers the three trends that I see appearing. And in relation to the last one, biometrics becoming invisible, I would also like to mention the Internet of Things, which is coming up and will be asking for authentication. Now, the problems that these things bring is a privacy problem that goes with the large databases, but it also goes with the mobile biometrics. The other problem that is there, especially with the mobile biometrics, is uncontrolled conditions. So we've seen presentations about that. We need to work on that. And I think that the Internet of Things would bring also privacy problems as well. So what we see central is probably privacy and uncontrolled situations. Nothing really new, actually, but becoming more urgent for the mobile world. So my proposal would be what is written over there, mobile biometrics and privacy, maybe including Internet of Things or having Internet of Things as a different topic.
Wrong, large-scale biometrics, Indian system, biometrics and mobile in uncontrolled conditions, invisible biometrics, biometrics and Internet of Things, and how to solve privacy concerns in that. Yeah?
So maybe I give some industry trends. I see that there is a battle on owning the identity in the internet, and the large, large-scale companies are actively participating, right? The Googles, the Apples, and so on. So I think the identity system in the internet will change over time. It might be less people which do authentication directly, and more people which have to rely on identity providers and want to rely on identity providers in one way or the other. If you look at systems like Alexa, this is always also sitting on that kind of trend, right? It's not the app anymore, the native app. It's some existing app which is dominated by a single player, and then someone else can hook into that. But the authentication, right, is something you get federated from that. So I think that seems to be a trend there. There's this concentration. Large players are working on owning the identity. When it comes to Internet of Things, I think the most realistic way to respond to that is not to offload the biometrics processing to the small Internet of Things devices. If you keep an approach where you have the biometrics processed in the device itself and use some standard cryptographic method to authenticate to the IoT device, it works pretty well, even in IoT space. And I think this is... this is very important to solve, because we have seen large-scale attacks already. I think last year in November it was at the time of the Arm Technology Conference, where there was a video camera with the empty default passwords which were misused to run a distributed denial-of-service attacks, which is really bad. And this was because of lack of authentication or weak authentication on the devices. So I think that's one of the topics where the industry has to work on. Other than that, presentation attacks is still, in my opinion, the most relevant thing.
Okay, I agree with Raymond's point of view, in the sense that I would like to, in my view, there are some trade-offs in biometrics, in the sense that from privacy concerns, together with my mobile, together with things going on locally, with respect to global things, big data, social exposure of the data. So what is the trade-off? Where are biometrics? What is the role of biometrics, and where biometrics are going to play a crucial role? Can we focus on one side or the other side, or we have to play in both sides? So that's my view. I think those are the topics that could be interesting in the near future.
Specific trade-off between biometrics and applications, or trade-off?
Between privacy concerns in a local mobile and my devices versus social exposure of data and big data things, and you know, things that are clearly seen, in invisibility or transparency of biometrics with respect to something which is very controlled. I saw that.
So I think that I would be very much intrigued by the combination between mobile devices and the continuous authentication. And when I talk about mobile devices, I'm not talking necessarily about smartphones, also tablets and other kind of devices that can adapt their functionalities and their needs according to the person who's holding, who's using it. So it could be authentication that can be used to adapt the device characteristics to the users, to the user. That's one issue. Of course, if we do this kind of continuous authentication, again, the privacy concern arises, because, of course, you would be able to get some information about the user habit and many other kind of information that can be used for some other purposes. So I see this kind of problem as an intriguing problem. So mobile, continuous authentication, and of course with respect to privacy concerns.
Okay, thank you. Capture that, Martin.
Yeah. I also think that presentation attack detection should be a focus, since we are using device which is we cannot really trust. It should be the security on the device should be in focus, and also, yeah. And also related to what Luke was talking about with the passport and these kind of things, if you could somehow have a supervised enrollment in your device or something like that for some high assurance enrollment that you could, for instance, use in banking applications or something like that. I don't know if that makes sense.
So now you had lots of time to think on your most favorite topic. No, you can.
I could complain again that everything has been said already. But I came up with one addition maybe. And you can see here that there is still a problem of where should you have the secureness on the device in a central service. And I would like to come back to the final part of my presentation, where I say, okay, a challenge response way of operating is, I think, a very powerful way of doing this. Because if you give a challenge and the response has to be something that the user can do, then with that you can verify that the user is really present, and you cannot do it by using a robot or whatever, or what the user is, or what the user has, for example. And if you can combine those things and make it transparent so that this is a natural thing, I think that would be a real addition to the whole approach. So we can use all the sensors on the mobile phone and maybe even other sensors that we have, and make a challenge response operation in such a way that it's also natural for the user and not bothering him or her. That would be, I think, the best way to try to solve these problems.
Yeah. Actually, I want to come with a proposal.
Yeah.
Because everyone has been using the word mobile, and all the things are several aspects of mobile. Now, if we look at the previous cost actions, one was on smart cards and biometrics, then there was forensics biometrics, and I think it would be good to have the third one be mobile and biometrics, and all these things could be addressed in work packages.
Yeah. Mobile and biometrics. Good. Thank you for that. That was, I think, a very good wrap-up from my perspective. And these are now various bullet points that we capture, and we will continue to discuss these in other opportunities and hopefully have, in the near future, a volunteer that would then generate a proposal for our community. Yeah, with that, I hand over to the chair of the day.
Your envelopes, this leaflet, which is the Carnahan Conference on Technology and Security and Technologies we are organizing in October in Madrid. Okay, it's supported by IEEE, so you can send your contributions before April the 28th. Okay, you have it in your this leaflet.
I'd like to thank all the panelists and the speakers for today's contribution. As it is said, all good things must come to an end. Our workshop is also coming to an end. I would like to acknowledge the contributions of okay. So I'd like to gracefully acknowledge the support of Research Council of Norway, who have funded us for carrying out this workshop. And I'd also like to thank the SWAN project and the NTNU for allowing us to host this event. And a special thanks goes to the list of speakers and the panelists who have contributed to the program today. The list of thanks would not be completed if I did not extend my thanks to all the members of NBL who have constantly supported in various activities of this workshop. Special thanks to Christoph, Raghu, and members of SWAN team, Pankaj, Martin, and visiting researcher Narayan. Finally, I would like also to thank the finance department who have been instrumental in carrying out the support in terms of administration and logistics for the workshop. And a special thanks to the SIT administration who have provided food and coffee for today's event. With that, I would like to conclude this workshop, and I would like to thank everyone who participated in this workshop and made this event a success. And we would like to look forward to receive you again in next year's event. Have a safe journey back home. Thank you.